secularism in Europe, religion and politics, why the public schools can't be fixed, why the United Nations flirts with abortion, why some couples say I do again, and why some women think they are priests. I'm Albert Moeller. It's Monday, September 20th, 2010, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Pope Benedict XVI concluded his final address during his state visit to Great Britain by speaking of what he warned as aggressive secularism that has taken hold in Europe. It's hard to deny the Pope's verdict here. After all, a simple look at the statistics tells a great deal of the story. Approximately 1 to 5% of citizens in Great Britain and in much of Western Europe attend church with any regularity at all. Some polls indicate that less than 10% of Britons claim any belief in God. In a remarkable statistic that came from a survey several years ago, upwards of 30 to 35% of Britons said they had no idea what Easter might have to do with religion. All of this is pointing to a radical secularization of a continent that had been, of course, predominantly Christian, and a culture that had been undoubtedly shaped by Christianity. The Pope, in speaking of this aggressive secularism, said, "In our time, the price to be paid for fidelity to the gospel is no longer being hanged, drawn, and quartered, but it often involves being dismissed out of hand, ridiculed, or parodied," end quote. Now, in this case, the Pope was pointing back to a time when Protestants and Catholics were at war, and in particular, he spoke of the deaths of Catholic martyrs at Tyburn, a notorious place of execution close to Hyde Park. Those were executed during the time of King Henry VIII and his successors. Of course, there were many Protestant martyrs under the reign of Mary Tudor, known as Bloody Mary. But the Pope's point is interesting here. We have now come to a point when secularism has now become so aggressive that believers in the Lord Jesus Christ are now marginalized in many sectors of society. It is not so much that in Western civilizations and cultures they are martyred, rather they are marginalized. And that is the way a secular culture defends itself, by marginalizing those who hold strong theological beliefs. The Pope is right, at least on this. Europe, the United Kingdom, and for that matter, much of North America is in the grip of an aggressive secularism, and we know that it comes with a remarkable spiritual cost. There's been a great deal of discussion in the United States about the degree to which a candidate's religious opinions and convictions should be a matter of the concern of voters. Now, Damon Linker is coming along writing, suggesting that, after all, it is a much bigger issue than most people acknowledge. Writing in the Washington Post over the weekend, Linker, who has written a book entitled The Religious Test, Why We Must Question the Beliefs of Our Leaders, comes along to argue that, in contradiction to the late President John F. Kennedy, who famously argued that a candidate's religious opinions and convictions should be of matter to himself and never to voters, Linker comes along to say that voters simply have to know what the religious beliefs of candidates are because they make a major difference. Now, let me be clear. Damon Linker is writing from the far left. He is suggesting, as a matter of fact, that evangelical Christians need to be outed, so to speak, because of beliefs about sexuality. He argues for a liberal, complete, legal deregulation of sexual ethics. But he's right, at least on this. You can't separate worldview from governance. You can't separate an individual's theological and spiritual convictions from how he or she sees the world and will operate as a political leader, or for that matter, as a citizen. Damon Linker is at least pointing to something that requires honesty here and an honest assessment. And even as I disagree with his analysis in terms of what should and should not be valued in this kind of spiritual convictions that are to be found in a candidate, or for that matter, in one's own neighbors, I do agree with him that you simply cannot marginalize or eradicate the question of theological conviction without denying the obvious when it comes to a political candidate or to anyone else. Trip Gabriel, writing in Sunday's edition of the New York Times, writes about a documentary that demonstrates why the public schools are so resistant to change. Davis Guggenheim, the very producer who brought about the An Inconvenient Truth film with the former Vice President Al Gore, has now produced Waiting for Superman, a documentary in which he demonstrates that the public schools have for some time been looking for some kind of individual salvation, someone to come along, a great leader, a great reformer, a great transformer, who would simply take a hold of American public education and change it fundamentally for the better. He writes that Superman simply does not exist. Waiting for Superman, he says, is a losing strategy. But something is really important in terms of this documentary, and it's important to recognize that it's coming from the secular left, not from the religious right. Mr. Guggenheim comes to the point that he accuses the public schools of being resistant to change for two fundamental reasons. In the first place, the schools are being asked to do what schools, per se, should probably never be asked to do. The schools are being asked to be engines for social transformation, for the elimination and eradication of poverty, and for dealing with social and individual pathologies in families that, quite simply, the schools are incapable of solving. The second reason, however, is more controversial and certainly more true when it comes to the actual frontline resistance to change, and this is what has caught the attention of many. Mr. Guggenheim argues that the public schools are resistant to reform because of the presence of so many bad and incompetent teachers who are protected by labor unions who simply resist any effort to hold teachers accountable. That's a brave word from the left, and one that ought to catch our attention as well. Chris Smith, writing at the Washington Post over the weekend, is writing about the United Nations and the upcoming meetings about the Millennium Development Goals. Mr. Smith, of course, is a congressman who serves as the ranking Republican on the House Foreign Affairs Subcommittee on Africa and Global Health. With these Millennium Development Goals in mind, Congressman Smith warns that the United Nations is flirting with abortion in a way that will be disastrous not only to these public policy proposals, but to the very impoverished and poor and needy people that the Millennium Development Goals are intended to help. He writes that the risk of the entanglement of the United States and the United Nations in abortion on the international scene is profound. I quote, "Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has said publicly that she believes access to abortion is part of maternal and reproductive health, thinking that runs contrary to the understanding of the more than 125 UN member states that prohibit or otherwise restrict abortion in their sovereign laws and constitutions." End quote. Now, there is a great deal of truth in what Congressman Smith is writing about here. This is a rather prophetic warning, especially with these meetings upcoming in the United Nations and with the debate, well, very seriously, ongoing. Congressman Smith writes this, "We've known for more than 60 years what actually saves women's lives." And by the way, this is reference here to maternal health, to women who die in childbirth. He says that the way that actually increases the likelihood that women will survive birth comes down to skilled attendance at birth, treatment to stop hemorrhages, access to safe blood, emergency obstetric care, antibiotics, repair of fistulas, adequate nutrition, and pre- and postnatal care. He says the goal of the upcoming summit should be a world free of abortion, not free abortion to the world. You know, when you look at this question, many of us would scratch our heads and wonder why the United Nations doesn't actually deal with health and try to save all life, rather than to be driven by ideologies and by ideological proponents who simply insist that abortion has to be included as a matter of maternal health. Congressman Smith is exactly right. It is a macabre, absolutely evil conflation to speak of health and then get to abortion. As he says, when it is talking here about health, it certainly isn't referring to the unborn child whose life is terminated. The UN goals must omit abortion. That's an important reminder from Congressman Chris Smith. There's another very interesting story in the New York Times Sunday. Maybe you saw it yesterday. It has to do with couples who are taking marriage vows again, and sometimes again, and again. Anna Jane Grossman is writing about something that many evangelical Christians have known about for some time. These are couples who are married and have been married and had a wedding, but are coming back to repeat and renew their vows. She writes this, "Up until recently, the wedding industry would have you believe that you had only one chance at the perfect day. So spare no expense. Be a princess for a day, invite 200 friends, and let it all pass by in a blur." Now, isn't it interesting that the New York Times turns the issue of marriage vow renewal into a commercial opportunity, talking about why the wedding industry has found this interesting? Well, the article is a little more complicated than that. you have the appearance of someone like Brad Wilcox, the sociologist, who says that this renewing of the vows has become something that couples have found to be helpful and perhaps even extremely helpful in reminding themselves both privately and publicly of what it means to be married. You also have others pointing that this particular pattern of renewing vows is something that some couples have come to because they feel the need and indeed perhaps even the assurance of standing up before witnesses and once again declaring that they are married to each other and fully intend to keep the wedding vows that they had previously made. For some years, evangelical Christians have been increasingly following this pattern where couples, especially on significant anniversaries, have before groups small or large declared their wedding vows. But as is so often the case, now there is a commercial opportunity that seems to have the attention of the media. And so the New York Times suggests that couples may do this not only periodically, but even annually and invite friends and throw a party. Well, I think this is just another symptom of the confusion of our day. And in a day of rampant divorce, well, I guess we should simply find some solace in the fact that the New York Times is celebrating actually married couples staying married and staying faithful to each other. If it takes a party to cement that and celebrate that, then so be it. At least it actually makes a mark for marriage. Time magazine is out this week with an interesting cover story that has to do with something that certainly should have our attention as well, and that is the political impact of the Tea Party. But that's not my interest as I look to this issue of Time magazine. Instead, on page 53, I find a story on women who believe themselves to be Catholic priests. Now, from an evangelical Christian perspective, there's a particularly interesting point here. Speaking of one of these women who simply declared herself to be a priest and found a renegade bishop who would ordain her, she says this, that she considers herself a validly ordained Catholic priest. Now, that's really interesting. She declares herself, considers herself to be a validly ordained priest. Well, you know, it's not only in the Catholic Church that there's this kind of confusion. Let's remind ourselves that ordination to ministry is not something one confers upon oneself, and what one considers oneself is not necessarily at all what's at stake or what's important. What's really important is who the church understands to be its pastors, whom the church appoints and sets aside and sets apart to be its teaching elders, to hold the teaching office of the church. You know, when I read this about these Roman Catholic women, my mind went to Charles Spurgeon, the great 19th century Baptist evangelical pastor in London. The story is told that one day a young man came to Charles Spurgeon and insisted that God had told him, although not the congregation evidently, that he was called to preach and was to preach that very day. Charles Spurgeon said, "Well, I tell you what, if you are absolutely sure, even though this church is not, that you were called to preach, then you may have my pulpit. You may have it at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. There is no one in the church at that time, but if you must preach, then have at it." Just another reminder to us that we live in a world of utter subjectivity when the temptation comes to all of us to think that we are what we declare ourselves to be. But in the Church of the Lord Jesus Christ, it just doesn't work that way. Something else that I have our attention today is the release, even today, of the White House diaries of former President Jimmy Carter. This is a publishing issue that certainly will be gaining a great deal of attention. I have already downloaded this book to my Kindle, and I'm looking forward to reading the White House diaries of President Jimmy Carter. The diaries of former President Ronald Reagan were a fascinating insight into that president and his philosophy of governance and his observation of the events of his day. Looking back to the late 1970s, it'll be interesting to see how former President Jimmy Carter thought of the events of the days, those days when he was in the White House, when they happened. This much is interesting. Anything that happens from the pen of a president of the United States is of interest, especially as he is reflecting on his own times. I'll let you know what we find. That book is certainly to become a topic of public debate and interest in days to come. I'm in Nashville, Tennessee. Over the past weekend, I was first in Chicago, Illinois, for the inauguration of Philip Ryken on Friday as the president of Wheaton College. That's an inauguration that should have the interest and the appreciation of evangelicals. He's a fine man who is going to one of the central institutions in the evangelical world. Pray for him. On Saturday, I was at Washington, D.C., actually the Fourth Presbyterian Church in Bethesda, Maryland, where I had the opportunity to speak to the Ligonier Ministries Regional Conference. I spoke there on the disappearance of God, on what it means to be a faithful Christian in the midst of a secular culture. I am this week at meetings of the Southern Baptist Convention's Executive Committee, and as always, I'm glad to be here with my Baptist colleagues, doing business, catching up, and seeing exactly what the Lord would have us to do in days to come. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, go to my website at albertmuller.com, where you will find a host of information and resources available to you. I hope you'll want to attend the Boyce College Preview Day on October 22nd. For more information, go to boycecollege.com. I'll see you tomorrow for The Briefing.